Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Hello, everybody. My name's Carly Findlay, and I would like to welcome you to the Growing Up in Disabled in Australia panel here at the Sydney Writers Festival. We're here today on Gadigal country, and I would like to pay my respects to the Aboriginal elders, past and present, and I extend my friendship to any Aboriginal people in the room and on stage with me today. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. And as a writer who was a guest on this land, I always love to give shout outs to Aboriginal writers. They've been telling their stories on this land for over 65,000 years. And I'm going to give a shout out to Gail Kennedy, who is on stage today. Gail's book is in the bookstore. Please go and buy it after the show. So my name's Carly Findlay, and I am talking here today with Alastair Baldwin, Gail Kennedy, Belinda Downs and Fee Murphy, and they are all contributors to Growing Up Disabled in Australia. This room is so full. Tim Minchin's in the other room. We might have a bigger audience than him. I did say to him before, do send all your white men audience over to us. He may well have done that. We got some product placement with Tim and the book as well. I am going to start by doing an image description, and I'm going to ask everybody on stage to introduce themselves and do an image description. I'm Carly. I am a woman in her late 30s wearing very bright clothes. I called it toddler chic. And we're on a stage with seven people, two Auslan interpreters and five speakers. Above us is a screen that says Growing Up Disabled in Australia, and in front of us is a massive audience. Alastair?
I am a white guy in his mid-20s with leg braces who wishes he was a natural blonde, but in fact just has frosted tips at the moment.
Gail.
I'm Gail Kennedy. I'm from the Wongaibon clan of the Nyampa-speaking nation of southwest New South Wales, and I'm wearing a black dress and a very colourful woolen scarf and a black hat, and I'm in a wheelchair.
Belinda.
Hi, I'm Belinda. I'm wearing my usual very brown top and black jeans as per my usual. And I have brown hair, and I'm just really pleased to be here.
Fee?
My name's Fiona Murphy. I'm a white woman wearing blue jeans, white shoes, and a maroon top, and I've got curly hair and glasses.
Thank you so much, everyone. So this session is going to be a discussion with the panel. The book is Growing Up Disabled in Australia, and it's been out since February, and it was due to come out in June, but we had a global pandemic due to come out in June last year. And I think it's been the best thing for this book to have saved it for this year. The book went to reprint after 2 weeks, which is amazing. It's received so much media, and yeah, we're all really incredibly proud of it, and I'm very, very proud that all of the contributors, the four contributors here today are on stage. We've got so many of them in the room as well. Oh, the other thing I was going to say is this event's being filmed for Compass as well. Gail's got a feature, and so the ABC's here. I'm not sure if I was meant to say that, but that's why there's some cameras in the room. All right, I'm going to start with the questions now. So I want to hear from each of you about what your story is about and why you submitted to the book.
I'll start. Yes, so the story I wrote for the anthology is called Hippotherapy, which means horse riding therapy, which is something that I, like many people who are children with a disability in this country, were weirdly made to ride horses due to some kind of not clear science that it's good for us. So I described essentially going out to this paddock next to a former Commonwealth Games stadium where there was just a bunch of horses and they'd plonked disabled children on them. And then I went into more detail about how a sort of WA trialing daylight savings led to a automatic sprinkler timer mishap that spooked my horse and sort of bucked me off it. But I didn't end up any more disabled than I already was. And yeah, it's just about this sort of weird aspect of disability culture, which is Disabled Saddle Club. I don't know if anyone in the audience did riding with the disabled Australia. But it's also about finding community with other disabled people through a shared interest, which might as well have been anything, but in my case, horses.
It's a very, very funny story. And when I narrated the audiobook, it took me double the time of everyone else's because I couldn't stop laughing at the visuals. What about you, Gail?
I wanted to contribute. I was hoping I would be chosen as a contributor because I wanted an Aboriginal voice in it, and I wanted an older Aboriginal voice. And I am that. In the wrong end of 60. But I felt it was really important that we got the voice of someone that became disabled in the 50s, and polio, and how attitudes have changed, and also I wanted to write about resilience, about overcoming a bad marriage, and also of dealing with depression when I, you know, after years and years of being able to walk, going into a wheelchair and having to, you know, mourn my old life. And that was really important. It was just kind of a year of just being depressed and sad, and then just sort of one day waking up and, you know, I mean, I knew I was in trouble when I went up the street in my tracky dacks and no Chanel number 5, and I thought, oh God, Gail, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
Because I just said, Gail, you're fucked. You know, I just caught sight of myself in the shop window, and I went, pick yourself up, girl, and I did, you know. And I actually realised that life was a lot easier for me once I did get into the wheelchair, which was... you know, I'd fought against it for so long and was just wearing myself out. And I think that for a lot of people it's really important to know that, you know, the wheelchair is a part of you. It's my legs. It enables me to get around the way I couldn't before. I am not confined to this. I really hate that she is or he is confined to a wheelchair. The wheelchair actually sets us free, and it's part of us. So I had a whole bunch of stuff I wanted to get off my chest, and I was really honoured to be part of the book.
Thank you, Gail. What about you, Belinda? Why did you write, and what's your story about?
Okay, so my story is called Having a Voice, and that title is a deliberate choice. It's not getting a voice or gaining a voice, it's having a voice, because part of having a voice is actually being heard and having somebody listen. And so my story is basically about information control and how information was not given to me so that I couldn't make decisions, but I made great decisions anyway. And so if you've read the chapter, you'll know the end of the story, but I'll try not to give it away. But basically, my late mum, Yvonne, who I'm happy to name, didn't get on very well with her. She would use that information control to try and get me into operations for my awesome face, and get money for that for her gambling addiction. And so I am able now to say, hey, she was a very broken person and it was not her fault that that was the way she dealt with things. She did it. She did the best she could, but what are the consequences for me? And it was a very dangerous story that needed to be told, and I am so honoured to be able to tell the story so that I know that I've since learnt that there's other people that this story has helped.
Thank you. Bea?
My story is about trying to learn how to read and write as somebody with hearing loss. And that was something that was an enormous challenge, but I was well supported by family as opposed to the schooling and classroom environment. And my parents were really motivated that I become literate and be able to kind of excel at school. So coincidentally, my mum found out about this form of technology called hearing glasses. Because of my form of hearing loss, there was no hearing aids that could correct or alter my hearing loss. But there are this elderly man working in the Sydney CBD. I don't think he invented them, but there was, I did deep Google searches into this later, but there's a form of glasses where you can loop hearing aids through them, but in order to get through the wires, they had to be quite enormous and really thick frames, and I was like a little kid suddenly rocking up to school with these kind of newsreader glasses are huge, and being like, I don't have a disability, what are you talking about? And these kind of wires coming through my ears. So the story is really kind of about me coping with suddenly an invisible disability becoming super visible. And I looked like a really earnest bureaucratic as a child. I was like, these glasses. But also just the support that I had from family as opposed to the education system, which was less supportive.
Thank you. I think what you all show today is just the diversity in disability that is in the book, and that disability looks very different for all of us. For many people who submitted or who wanted to submit but didn't, they were saying, I didn't know if I could, because they see disability in a certain way. And it, for me, it was very important to include all of you and the other contributors, because everyone has a different experience of disability. And when we talk about the social model of disability, where there are barriers at fault, not our bodies, that really shows the diversity that we have and also the strength that we have as well. So the next question I have for you is, why do you think it's so important for disabled people to tell our own stories?
We'll keep doing this loop. For me in particular, I was very keen to, write a funny story, because I feel, certainly in the comedy world, the general history of disability in comedy is disabled people being the punchline to set ups by abled comedians. And not only is this sort of a power imbalance that means that historically disabled people have not been able to thrive in comedy as abled people have, I also think abled people are less funny. It's not their fault. And they try really hard. Maybe they did something bad in a past life. I don't want to conjecture, but I was just very keen to write a funny story about disability as a disabled person, because I think, you know, the quality is better when we're telling our own stories and making our own jokes.
I totally agree. I sometimes get called on to speak at various things, and I often will tell a funny story, and it's amazing, you know. It usually involves very earnest, very well-meaning people, and you know, like, they're always really surprised when, you know, they've rushed over and offered to help me and get me a drink and take me to the toilet. And when they say, can I do anything for you? And I say, yes, you could fuck off. That'd be a really good, that'd be a really good start. I didn't really actually start writing about disability until a few years ago because all of my writing's been, not identifying as a person with a disability because I didn't think it was necessary to what I was writing. But now I've been, I've woken up, and think it's really important, specifically for kids. And I've been asked to write a little comic strip for a great little magazine called Cookie that's a really alternative magazine for girls. And I'm going to be working with a manga artist. And I've actually, the heroine is in a wheelchair. And I thought, I thought that was a breakthrough for me, but it's also a breakthrough for publishing across the board, and for other young girls to see, hey, specifically if you're somebody who's disabled and you're different, you're different. So, so now it's sort of starting to inform my writing as much as being Aboriginal does.
Okay, so there's two reasons for me. And first of all, when I was 17, I realised that facial difference was not very well represented in media at all. Where either I've got this little model, do you mind? Have, H-A-V-E, we're either in hospital or we're aliens or we're victims or we're evil. Okay. And I'm like, nah, none of the above. So that's been a passion of mine for many years, and that's partly why I do the work that I do. But also my day job, I have the best day job. I get to teach, I'm a linguist, and I get to teach teachers about language so they can teach about better language. I won't say proper because that's a bit of anathema to linguists, but to teach better language skills to their kids. And I just find so much joy in having teachers realise that they have the power to give their children a voice. And so for me, those two things kind of come together. And of course, my chapter was called Having a Voice. So, so they're the two reasons.
I can definitely relate to a lot of what's been said already, and the main reason with my particular piece that I kind of wanted to write it was just to show that hearing loss and deafness is more of a spectrum than quite a specific diagnosis that generally the general public believe. If you say you're deaf, the general perception is that you're profoundly deaf and can't hear or experience sound in different ways, whereas it is a spectrum of experiences with any form of hearing health issue, and sound can actually be more intrusive and overwhelming and confusing for people who have hearing loss, because we're trying to decipher and understand so much information in a way that is meaningful. So I kind of really wanted to show the sort of invisible work that happens to kind of understand and engage in environments. And particularly, whilst it is difficult, I wouldn't trade it for anything because there's so many positives that come out of that experience as well. So I kind of wanted to show that it isn't one or the other, but it's complex and ever-changing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think for me, in wanting this book to be published, you're all right in saying that disability is represented in such a poor way in literature and the media, and this is such a great, entry point for people, for readers into disability, into own voices. I'm pretty sick of disabled characters written as an alien, a hero, or in hospital, or a villain. And I'm really concerned about the steps that books go through in a publishing house to be approved and to be published when some of the tropes, the disability tropes, are so bad. And we really need to change that. We really need to encourage own voices, sensitivity readers, if not own voices, and have more of us on the shelves. I can say that through this book, there are a number of people who have been signed to an agent now, and there are people who are meeting with other publishers and, you know, have had opportunities, which is amazing, and that's because of own voices. I'm going to ask you what you want readers to get from this book. I want both disabled and non-disabled readers to take different things from this book, but I'd love to hear from you what you'd like.
For me, I think with abled readers, it's not so much what they'll take from the book, it's me taking money from them. But, I mean, I don't know, I just think for an abled reader, I think just them having an awareness that there are these worlds which exist, which I think due to, you know, abled people perceiving themselves as neutral, as a blank canvas, they don't think about, oh, down the road, down that dirt road, there might be, you know, a disabled saddle club or something like that. I think the great thing about this anthology is that it's a doorway into a myriad of different worlds and experiences. And I think not only do you walk away reading the book as a collective thing with a broader understanding of disability, I think it also stokes a curiosity, but an earnest curiosity to understand in a three-dimensional way disability more, because you see how broad it can be and how diverse it can be. So for an abled reader, I hope it gives them, I guess, a curiosity to read disabled people more. And for disabled readers, I just, you know, I think it's nice to feel seen and represented. And, you know, there's a lot of jokes in my piece which aren't for abled people, but I certainly hope that disabled readers got a bit of fun out of it, you know?
Gail?
It's really good for us to not only have written our own stories, but to be the ones that are actually speaking about it, you know? And the editor is a disabled person, which is incredible. And I remember being infuriated a few years ago, which actually got me sort of started, made me start thinking about writing from a disabled point of view, was that an American guy had put together a book of stories about written by disabled people, but he was the one getting all the glory. He was the one that was flying around the world. He was the one on stage, you know, and I was so angry because, to me, he'd stolen their stories. And he didn't write them, he didn't tell them, he was the editor. And I thought, I wanted to see the people that had written them up on stage, like we are today, telling our story. And again, as you were saying, you know, like we're just positioned in books and films. You know, like the greatest thing you can possibly do for someone is just go and die. You know, I mean, why do they do that? And they make us the pitying, and they steal our heroes. And you know, like I just thought, with Stephen Hawking, he was so resolutely disabled, so proudly disabled. Here was the greatest mind in the world in a wheelchair with an obvious disability who didn't see the wheelchair as being confined. As a, you know, he lived in this incredible brain, and when he died, it was like the able-bodied community found a chance to pounce on him and reclaim him. And there were all these disgusting memes of him, you know, dressed like someone out of Mad Men, you know, leaping out of his wheelchair and running up a golden staircase. You know, and I thought, oh my God, you know, he would be so infuriated. He'd be so furious. And they steal people like Frida Kahlo from us. And we don't get, the wider public don't get to see us as people. They don't get to see and recognise our talent and our vitality. And I think that we're now on the cusp of something really good. Our voice is being heard. And what's wonderful is that we've got a packed house of people who want to hear us and who want to read us. So I think we're well on our way.
I feel like we need a clap after that. Belinda?
Can you repeat the question?
I couldn't even remember the question.
I was so enthralled.
I was so engrossed by Gail as well. I totally forgot my question. What do you hope readers get from the book?
Oh, okay. Thank you. So for me, I hope that people's perspective changes, that I think there's a question later that I'll refer to this again, but for me it's all about framing, and I hope that the framing of disability changes markedly, that we're not just one-dimensional people that are, you know, going to die in the movie, that we are people whose life experiences are valuable. And not only do, like, for example, do I like my face, I wouldn't swap it for the world. You know, I was born with a tessier cleft, and it doesn't matter if you don't know what that is. But I love it, and I always have. I have said no to operations, and that absolutely flummoxes people, that I would choose not to have operations to fix my face. And so this experience of people sharing their stories and sharing their authentic stories and stories from them is so incredibly valuable, and not to have all these things put upon us. So that's what I hope that people get from the book.
Absolutely. I'm just looking at the index here, and I know that Andy Jackson, Elle Gibbs, and also Eliza Hull all have lines in their story around never needing fixing, literally the same lines, and Belle's onto that as well. And I feel that with me as well. People are astounded that I don't want to take drugs to make myself less red. And you, Fee?
I think that's so much has started to shift, even to have a book in Australia published with the word disabled in it is really shifting in a really, not forceful way, but in a way that is direct and proud, that we can use the word disabled without any qualifiers around it of person with disability. And the fact that that language in the media, in conversations, is starting to shift, I think is going to really send out a kind of shockwaves of change in a really kind of subtle and profound way. Of already friends and family I know are comfortable with using the word disabled people, whereas even a year ago, two, three, a decade ago, it was very much with disability. So I think that specific change and really pushing for that as well, making sure that it is growing up disabled in Australia, is a significant change for the future going forward of really centering our voices, that we own them and we are going to continue to share them.
We've had a lot of not complaints, people speaking up about the term disabled in the title. One of the things that I've done with the contributors and also for the media is put together a contributor kit and a media kit around, particularly for the media, around that it is okay to use the word disabled. In nearly every event we've done, we've had people who have raised their hand and said, why is disabled in the book? And they felt very uncomfortable. On April 1st, which is April Fun Day, I've replaced the ableist word in that. I talked to my publisher, the publisher Black Ink, and I said, can we do an April Fun Day joke? And her partner made some mock-up covers for the book, and they were growing up differently abled in Australia, growing up special needs in Australia, growing up we can't even say this word in Australia. And growing up, I don't even see your disability in Australia. And so I you know, we've got a little contributor group happening on Facebook, and I sort of, you know, got the okay from the contributors to do this, and I put it up, and there was so much fanfare. People believed it. People also don't read any captions, and a lot of service providers, actually, disability service providers, were saying, "Oh, congratulations on the new book." I made a statement to say we really listened to the non-disabled people about what they want, and it's about time they were centred. But the interesting thing was, I thought that it was great to see disabled people responding and recognising that we've developed a level of trust here with Black Ink, and so there were some of them were quite angry. How could Black Ink turn on us like this? But you know, overall it was a lot of fun, and I think that it really got people thinking about the language. And I have had a lengthy document sent to me from a person who is committed to changing the word disability, and he's done an incredible amount of work, and I said, maybe you should go and write a book. So I want to ask now, and I know we don't have that much time for this question, but I want to ask, what do you think the most pressing issue is for disability and disability rights issues right now? Given everything, the shit show of the world, of Australia, maybe we should just limit it to Australia. What do you think the most pressing issue is, and how do you solve it? Sorry, that's a really big question in 20 minutes.
Oh, it's so easy to go first. Well, for me, and this is the obvious one, and I'm sure other people agree, I think it is access, because disabled people, we each have different things that we care about, different things that we want to change in this country, but the rooms where these arguments and forums are being held aren't always welcoming to us. We can't always literally get there. And so, you know, I think I personally, what I care about as a disabled person is very different to what everyone else on this stage thinks, to every other disabled person in the crowd. But I think the common factor is that we all want the equal opportunity to advocate for what we need, and until every room, you know, in Parliament is accessible, every comedy room, that's where I do all my advocacy, is accessible, I think, there will always be, you know, a side of the discussion that is ignored. And I don't think that's acceptable anymore, and it never was in the first place. But yeah, accessibility. So I've done that one. What's left?
Oh, God, accessibility. You know, that's one of my biggest bugbears. You know, like I might want to go and see a band and they don't have disabled access, you know, and I go, why not? And they go, well, we're a heritage building. And I said, what do you mean you're a heritage building? I said, I've been around Europe, you know, they made the Louvre accessible. They've made all these really old museums and that accessible. And you're telling me that your shitty little pub in Piedmont can't be accessible because it's heritage. And, and it's restaurants. It's just so tiring to have to ring up and say, do you have wheelchair accessible? Are you wheelchair accessible? And they go, yes. I go, but are you wheelchair accessible? Well, we've got one step, you know. And I go, oh, you know, so you're not wheelchair accessible. You know, access is one of my biggest bugbears. Planes, you know, a lot of them don't have toilets in them for us to use. I mean, they spend all this money making these really luxurious first class and business class cabins. Why can't they put on there a proper disabled toilet so people can actually use the toilet on a plane and can actually travel?
We need first class jets for disabled people.
I think we do, just for us.
Yeah.
and equity, you know, equality. I think a lot of it should start with able-bodied people, because a lot of the changes that have been made have come from able-bodied people who found themselves disabled. And they're going, oh, gee, I can't, what do you mean I can't go there anymore? And so they're the ones that often yell the loudest. But anyone can be an advocate for us. If you go to a place, if you go to a restaurant, if you go somewhere, if you go to a theatre and you see that something doesn't have access, what about an email or a heads up to the people that actually own that establishment? I mean, I quite understand if you're able-bodied that we are the last people that you're thinking about, but maybe it's time that you did. Maybe it's time that you thought, my brothers and sisters out there in the disabled community, because we are brothers and sisters, they would like to come to this event, they would like to go to this restaurant, they would like to do, you know, I mean, speak up, be our allies, you know, don't just look at us, you know, if you're going to look at us as inspirational, let that inspiration do something, let it be practical inspiration, let us inspire you to do things that benefit us, like, hey, get a ramp in here. If you can't build one, just there are lots of portable ones that you can put out. Do something about your toilet. Don't fill your disabled toilet up with boxes of food and things that don't use it as a storeroom. You know, I mean, check these things out and be our ally. Let the inspiration be a practical inspiration, not an inspiration where you think, oh, look at those poor things, and here I am whinging because, you know, there was skin on top of my porridge this morning. You know, let it be practical.
Mm. Bell?
Well, I totally agree with the access thing, and I'm going to add something in 2 seconds. But how many businesses have you heard say, but we don't have any disabled people come to our business? I wonder why. So I agree with the access, and I'm also going to say reframing. Disability desperately needs to be reframed. And when I say reframing, I don't mean, this is what not to do to disabled people, because that's just frankly weird. It's also not, this is what you do to disabled people, because again, yeah, that's really weird. And also, do you notice that people confuse pity with kindness? So that message of be kind is often have pity, and it just does my head in. I've got a friend that I annoy quite frequently, and I'm saying, this person was trying to be kind to me and they just failed. And most of the time he doesn't answer, and that's okay. So don't blame him. But the proper way, to reframe is to put us in our proper context, which is as part of the community. And to put disabled people in the community as who we are as people is the reframing that we need. We are not other, we are part of the community. Mm-hmm. So I will add reframing.
Yes. Absolutely. And Fee?
I wholeheartedly agree with everything that's already been said by the panellists, and I think having disabled voices in rooms of power is essential to change the specific wording of our current policies, because there are ableist ideals deeply threaded through all social policy, financial policy, all policy in Australia is deeply, deeply ableist. Including our migration policy, which is incredibly ableist at barring disabled people from becoming Australian citizens. That's a global issue as well. But also our workplace policies, where it's the onus is and labour is always on the disabled person to disclose and ask for access. There's little to no onus on institutions and structures that exist. And I think that really needs to flip, because the reframing is that we're the burden sucking up resources, when really we're using all our skills and knowledge and community to try and navigate these systems that were designed to exclude us. And until those systems are redesigned, it's an ongoing fight, which is exhausting.
There are so many more issues we could cover, but we don't have too much time, I'm sorry. We are going to run a little overtime today, which is great, because we're on crypt time here. And that is fine for everybody to take their time in coming in and also take our time telling our stories. So our tech people have said, it's okay if you go overtime. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions and I'm going to open it up to the audience. I want to know what is next for you in your writing career, because this book is a launch pad for all of you.
Well, for me, I'm a TV writer, and I'm fortunate I'm working on The Weekly at the moment on ABC, and I've started writing for 2 murder mystery shows, which is very fun. I weirdly prefer doing that than watching 8 hours of news a day. I don't know why, it's better for my mental health. But beyond that, I mean, being in this anthology really opened the door for me to signing with a literary agent. So in the back end of this year, I will be completing my manuscript, Invalid Memoir, which will be a collection of autofiction about...
Is that word allowed on a book?
Well, if you criticise me, then it's invalid memoir, because it'll be 90% made up. So it's a bit of a... Disabled people are great with loopholes. but, yeah, and that'll just be a collection of very fun, 90% fictionalised experiences based on the real weird things that people say to me specifically and about disabled people in general. So I'm looking forward to doing that. And and I'm on a panel like in 2 hours from, so come to that. It's about satire. That's in the immediate future. long term, a book. Yes.
Amazing. Gail.
I'm writing a one-woman show for Giant Dwarf here in Sydney, and I've just got some extra funding, which means I can get things like a nice dress and a makeup artist and maybe some music, but that will take me from childhood through to about the age of 19. And I've been wrestling with a memoir for a few years now, not being able to find the right voice, the right rhythm, and I finally found a way to put it together that suits me. So I guess it's what you would call discontinuous narrative. And so it's vignettes, really. So I'm halfway through that now, but just doing it to I was born, da-da-da-da-da, just wasn't working for me. So now, after a few years, I'm finally, halfway through that.
Amazing. Belle?
Cool. Okay, I'm going back to my day job soon. Life. So I teach linguistics. But book-wise, I'm actually planning a book. Here we go. I'm actually planning a book that I don't know how many people have seen books where there's a disability or a facial difference and it's the focus of the story. Like, so the reason why the disability is in the story is so that it could be the focus. I actually didn't like the book Wonder. I'm sorry. I won't go into that. But basically what I'm hoping to do is to write a book that has facial difference in it, where the facial difference is not the plot point, the main plot point. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Me too. Fee?
I've just finished writing a book, so a little bit tired, about deafness and learning Auslan. It's called The Shape of Sound, but kind of the really great thing about being part of the disability community and having conversations with so many disabled people is the amount of going to use the word inspiring, not as in like, you know, we're inspiring people, but the amount of creativity that's happening in the disability community is the most exciting place in Australian arts, I believe, because it's so dynamic. So I'm just really reading and watching as much as I can and slowly starting to research another collection of essays around the ideas of the phrase dignity and respect, which kind of crops up time and time again in funding applications for NDIS or any healthcare sort of thing, and really trying to dismantle the phrases and who came up with them, how they're used to manipulate situations, and what it means to kind of live in a society that believes that it's fair. So lots of fun research to do.
It's so exciting to hear about all your plans. I must say, I'm so proud to be up here with everybody. It's just amazing to have read all of the submissions and now be at this point where the book's published and where, you know, talking to so many different people at events. So the last thing I'm going to ask all of the panel is, what is their favourite chapter in the book other than their own?
Oh, this one is easy for me. I love Et Lux by Robin Eames, who is in the audience, so everyone can applaud. It's just, it bowled me over. It's such a beautiful piece, and the anthology is great, but that story alone is worth the cost, so I thoroughly recommend it. It's, yeah, a beautiful dissection and discussion around living and dying with disability, family, and the interconnectedness of disability within familial relationships. It really is so beautifully written. So skip to that one first if you buy the book, and then go back to mine, and then these guys, and then the rest. That's my official ranking.
Gail.
I've been asked the question and I'm afraid I've been left wanting. I haven't read it.
I don't know what to say.
I got asked the same question in the last panel I was in, and I hadn't read that either, so don't get upset. It's just that I'm writing at the moment, yeah. And I'm one of these people, I can't read a book when I'm writing. And I've been writing continually for the last 11 years, so I can't remember the last book that I read. So
there might be a number of new editions by the time you get to reading this one.
I will start dipping into it sooner or later, but yeah, I haven't read it. I'm sorry.
Okay, so I enjoyed every story that I read, but I was particularly enamoured by Kerri-Ann Messenger's poems, Life Goes On and The Blue Rose. So I really enjoyed that poetry.
Kerri-Ann wrote her poems about being a person with Down syndrome, and she wrote those poems at a conference for people with intellectual disabilities, and that was incredible to see. She submitted, I think, more than two poems, and we chose two, and it was just amazing that there's a lot of gatekeeping in the disability community, in the sector, and so it was very important for me to include that. But I was so excited that they had a session at this Valid conference where they wrote for the book. We had a few submissions from Valid. It was amazing. Fee?
Carly emailed this question through, and I was like, of all the questions, I was sweating over this one because I'm not exaggerating in that. Yeah. There's so much I got out of this book. If pressed to choose, Jasmine Sharif's Mother Hand, their work, they are an incredible zine maker, poet, essay writer based in Victoria. The title alone is so brilliant, to see deafness kind of come through language with Mother Hand, a play on the idea of mother tongue. But their kind of playfulness with grammar and grammar conventions and really throwing that out the window to be as deaf as possible on the page. As a deaf writer myself, I feel like I've learned so much from their work, and it's thrilling to read, absolutely thrilling to read.
Thank you, everyone. And we're going to open up questions to the audience. We probably have about 7 minutes of them. Anyone got a question? Come to the stand or put your hand up and a mic will come to you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for such a great book, such a brilliant read, and for sharing your stories today. I feel like disabled writing is having a moment at the moment. There's so many great books coming out by incredible disabled writers. And Carly, I'm sure you were bowled over for submissions and this book could have been a lot longer than it is. And just kind of wondering, what do we need to do as a society? What does the literature sector need to do to kind of build and continue this momentum so that it's not a, I guess, a passing phase and that, you know, it's not a moment, but it is the future?
Great question. Thank you. Is it okay if I add to the answer? You all can answer as well. I wrote Say Hello a few years ago, my memoir, and I really learnt that there is so far to go, particularly in promoting the book. It's very hard to be a writer and sell your book when you have to constantly advocate for access. And so we really need bookstores, we need event organisers to understand basic access, but also understand that access is broader than offering a ramp or Auslan. There's so many individual types of access, and so I really believe that the sector needs to do that. I think that when there is a writer, a non-disabled writer, who is writing disability, I think, as well as a sensitivity reader, a publisher needs to look at, to have a really frank conversation with that writer and say, why are you writing this character? What is your aim? Is this the best representation of disability? I know I've been incredibly disappointed to see short lists and long lists of books that include the R word. Really negative stereotyping of disability. And, you know, as I said before, that the publishing house, you know, that there's a number of people in there. There's the, well, there's the agent before it gets to the publishing house, and then there's a, you know, commissioning publisher or editor, and there's the editor, and there's the marketer or publicist. And there's all these steps that a book has gone through to be approved, and yet we're still seeing the R word in the book. We're still seeing disability as a tragedy. And then these books are still up for awards, and that's not good enough, you know? One of the things that we talked about, I don't know which panel it was on. Oh, that's right, it was on our Rabble Books panel. And Sandy Parsons, who's in Growing Up Disabled, was saying that she has been a children's writer for a long time, and she had this story that she submitted to Growing Up Disabled. Oh, it's called Don't Have a Bird, that's right. And she wrote about her life with cystic fibrosis and her friendship with another person with cystic fibrosis. And she was saying that the judges in writing competitions and anthologies aren't disabled. And so she was getting rejection after rejection, and it took me to find value and worth in her story and say it is worthy of being published. So we need to be in every room, as Fee said, we need to be making decisions. Does anyone else want to contribute to that?
Just on a practical level, Writers Victoria have and Arts Access Victoria have done a tremendous amount of work to try and upskill and educate the publishing industry to be more accessible on a whole range of ways with the publishability kind of information packs that they have. There's too much information to go into detail at the moment, but there are resources and organisations and individuals with knowledge and expertise about how to fix the issues upon issues upon issues that exist in the industry. And I think that needs to be acknowledged, that the work shouldn't fall upon the disabled writer, author to take the burden of that, but it should be a systemic change that happens throughout, because like Carly said, far too many ableist slurs end up in the book, so you can only imagine that the amount of disabled people in publishing houses, the stats show, is quite small. So it really needs to change the overall structure of what happens in publishing. Mm.
Many of us on this stage are freelancers. Give us a job.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just for International Day with People with Disabilities, but all year round.
I know, it's a busy week that week. I'm going to ask for another question from the audience.
Look, my question's about politics, so I apologise for that in advance, but there it is. On the political spectrum, you've got the Liberal Progressive, and I'm sure you have your gripes with them, but at least they're trying. On the other end of the spectrum, we've got conservatism, and you know, you only need to look at some of President Trump's comments, albeit in a different country, on disability there. I just wondered, for each of you, I mean, when the very nature of that conservative side of politics is to preserve and conserve the status quo and not to move things and not to make the kind of changes you've all talked about, how do you try to persuade the mind of that side of politics? And we've known or seen in recent US history, for example, that just purely attacking those people doesn't really work. So how would you persuade the mind of that conservative voter?
What a big question, Belle.
I can have a go at answering your question. I do have a little bit of a political bent. I'm not going to tell you which way I go. But I found that when people hold very conservative views about disability, it's probably because they've not actually met a person like a disabled person. And so when they meet a disabled person, they go, oh, actually, there's humanity here. There's a person here. And that's how we change the minds. It's not a top-down thing. I think it's a bottom-up thing. It's about personal relationships. Do you see that? Yeah. So for me, it's about personal relationships, about getting those people one-on-one, and that conservatism tends to drop off because I'm going to be really political here. It's a lot of it's about fear, and so fear of disability, for example. And so when they meet a disabled person, they go, "Oh, actually, they're not so scary after all."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fee?
I think that there's a lot of work done about that isn't being taken up on a political scale of the economics of care. A lot of people see care as a cost rather than an investment. A lot of people view the caring relationship as a one-way street where the disabled person is taking from society rather than the contribution that we have to offer on all levels of society. There's a great deal of intelligence, creativity and innovation that disabled people have to offer. And unfortunately, it feels like we are trying to express this, but the message isn't being taken up. But I think if it is shifted for those quite conservative viewpoints to an economic conversation, really, we need to put more investment into care because that's really how other work gets done. As the phrase say, care work is the work that allows other work. And at the moment, we're still pulling funding away from all public resources. And that's having detrimental impacts on not just people who are disabled, but all people of society. So I think the economics of it really needs to be challenged because at the moment, the idea of the GDP as being product outputs is detrimental to the well-being of all society.
Mm. Mm. Does anyone else want to answer that?
Said it all.
No, I'm just waiting for them to die. I don't have any plan. One fellow serial killer clapping with me. I think you can really Trojan horse a lot of disability rights into aged care rights and rights for the elderly, because a lot of people just make weird arbitrary distinctions between being old and being disabled, but aging is just the process of naturally acquiring disabilities until you get that final disability death. And so if you're lucky, you will grow to become disabled rather than just dying like that. So I don't know. I just think reminding people about their own mortality and trying to leverage their own self-interest into caring about their fellow human. I mean, it's ideally they would just care, but if that doesn't work, just scare them.
I'm going to end on letting people know about the amazing work, and I'm not sorry to single her out, Elle Gibbs, and many, many other disabled activists are doing incredible work around the NDIS independent assessments and a plethora of other issues that the government is fucking up. And so do go and follow people like Elle, people like Marley Hermans, people like Hannah Morphy Walsh, on Twitter and see the issues and see the work that disabled people are putting in to change lives and to change the country. Also, just vote them out and vote us in. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. This has been an incredible discussion. And as I said, I'm so proud. We do want a bit of a photo with the Growing Up Disabled contributors first, and then we'll be in the book signing area. Go buy our books. Go buy our books for your friend who thinks that disability is a bad word. Thank you so much, Sydney Writers Festival, for having us. And thank you to our Auslan interpreters as well.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.